From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the studios of KMLB in Monroe, Louisiana. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This is a week when we're going to eat a lot of food and call it patriotic. But today, we're going to give you a lot of food for the mind. That, too, is patriotic.
Well, coming on the Leadership Institute, I've learned that interfaith is really important on campuses.
My story of interfaith and environmental organizing begins back in high school.
Service has been such a part of my life and my faith.
A few weeks ago, 200 young people gathered in Washington, D.C. for two interfaith leadership institutes. Chris Stedman participated as a mentor and found the event surprisingly welcoming to non-believing interfaith activists. He's one of them. And he'll talk to us about the promise and potential of this trend on this week's State of Belief Radio.
I've asked to sit down soon with leaders of both parties so that we can have an extended discussion about what we can do together.
To the extent that the president wants to work with us on reducing the size, scope, and intrusion of the federal government, we're willing to work with him.
I believe there's room for us to compromise and get it done together. Let's start where we agree.
I am not going to compromise on my principles.
I recognize that both parties are going to have to work together and compromise to get something done here.
Nor am I going to compromise the will of the American people.
Compromise. It's how most things get done in Washington and in our daily lives, too. But there are a lot of issues political conservatives and political progressives can't even imagine compromising on. Usually that's because ethics are involved, deeply held beliefs and values that are often inseparable from personal morals and even identity. Sometimes this is inseparable from matters of faith. We're going to explore the ethics of compromise with Dr. Robert Parham, founder and executive director of the Baptist Center for Ethics in Nashville, Tennessee.
It is bring on the mud time out there, and the fight to hold on to seats in Congress getting pretty nasty.
Did you misrepresent the facts to score political points?
What's the name of the woman who made these allegations?
The press may be laughing, but the witches aren't.
In an election season, it's easy to get distracted by anecdotal and extreme examples of almost any kind of rhetoric and start imagining a pattern or even a fundamental change in our nation. Are we changing? Is religion's role in American politics and culture shifting? Or was it primarily just used in an undeniably craven way as a vote-getting weapon? Religion News Service editor Kevin Ekstrom will help us navigate those challenging waters later on this week's show. Chris Stedman is the managing director of State of Formation, a new initiative at the Journal of Interreligious Dialogue. Chris received an MA in religion from Meadville Lombard Theological School at the University of Chicago. He's the founder and author of the blog Nonprofit Status. His writing also has appeared in venues such as the Washington Post on Faith, Tikkun Daily, The New Humanism, and more. Chris also serves on the leadership team of the Common Ground Campaign, a coalition of young people standing up in response to the recent wave of anti-Muslim rhetoric and violence in the United States. Chris, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
I was very interested in your recent Huffington Post article about the Interfaith Leadership Institutes held in Washington, D.C. last month, and especially about how inclusive the events felt for a non-religious interfaith activist like yourself. Tell me a little about that.
Sure. So I've been involved with the work of the Interfaith Youth Corps for a couple of years now. I started as an intern and have continued to be very active in the interfaith youth movement that they are working to build up. One of the things that I have been working a lot on is trying to find ways to bridge the large chasm that exists right now between Americans who self-identify as non-religious and those who are religious. Mm-hmm. I think this is a gap that is filled with misunderstanding, misinformation, and, you know, Eboo Patel, the founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Corps, says himself that he thinks perhaps the largest faith divide in America is between the religious and the secular.
Right.
And so this is something that I think is really important for the interfaith movement to address. And it's, you know, as a non-religious individual myself, it's something that I have been really excited to see growing in the interfaith movement. You know, every time I work with the Interfaith Youth Corps on an interfaith event, I see more and more non-religious people showing up. And I just think it's a really big sign of progress for the movement.
Chris, my understanding is that the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships organized these Interfaith Leadership Institutes. Is that right?
Well, so the Interfaith Youth Corps actually organized it, but they co-hosted it with the Georgetown University Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, and then the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships hosted a session for each institute. So for the first institute, they hosted the opening session, and then they did the same for the second institute as well.
I see. What do you think the mix of these two groups, the non-affiliated, as some would say, and the affiliated, as some would say, what is the promise of that?
I think one of the biggest focuses of what I'm trying to do in my sort of work at large is to actively identify opportunities for collaboration and greater understanding between the religious and the non-religious. I think, unfortunately, a lot of what happens for non-religious people, whether they grow up religious and then decide for themselves that they are no longer religious, or they grow up in a non-religious home, I think the sort of larger cultural narrative on what it means to be non-religious is often equated with being anti-religious.
Right.
And so I think what that lends itself to is this almost culture war between the forces of secularism and the forces of religiosity that, you know, unfortunately leads to a lot of conflict, when I think there is, in fact, you know, a great number of values and issues that religious people and non-religious people can come together around. And if, in a culture that is very, you know, politically and religiously divided, I think, you know, that kind of unity is really needed, especially around really, you know, important issues.
I'm wondering, I can't help wonder, because we focus so much on the First Amendment and its religious liberty clauses and government funding of religion, that kind of thing. Were there any questions raised about the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives devoting federal tax dollars to support interfaith organizing?
So I think that's a great question. And it's, you know, as somebody who was there as an IFYC alumni to really work with the students to sort of guide them in their vision for what they wanted to accomplish on their campuses, something I probably can't speak to as much. I can say that, you know, the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships hosted a sort of an opening session, and then the rest of the institutes were conducted at Georgetown University. And I think one of the ways to sort of, you know, ensure that there is not an issue there with, you know, the White House being involved in promoting faith-based work is to say the interfaith movement is not about promoting a specifically religious agenda. It's about promoting an agenda that is, you know, universalistic. It's something that religious people, non-religious people can get behind, which is, you know, actively seeking ways to collaborate around important social issues, whether it is the separation of church and state, whether it's, you know, malaria eradication, which the IFYC has done a lot of work with the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, or other, you know, other causes that could be construed, you know, as purely secular causes, but giving both religious and non-religious people reasons from their own sort of value structure in those efforts.
My guest has been Chris Stedman, the Managing Director of State of Formation from the Journal of Interreligious Dialogue. Follow his blog at nonprofitstatus.com. Chris, I think we'll be talking some more about this. We appreciate your perspective, and thanks for joining us today on State of Belief.
Thank you very much. It was a total pleasure.
Still ahead on this week's show, Ethics and Compromise with Dr. Robert Parham of the Baptist Center for Ethics. But first, Religion News Service editor Kevin Ekstrom will help us take the pulse of religion in post-election America. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Don't go away, please. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's hard to keep personal biases out of journalism. And that's particularly true when the topics covered are as personal as religion and faith. And Religion News Service has been unusually successful in covering stories on faith and ethics from a secular perspective for a number of years now. Kevin Ekstrom joined RNS in 2000 and was named editor in 2006. In 2007, he was elected president of the Religion News Writers Association. And as we try to sort out what's significant and what's trivial in the recent spate of news on religion and politics, it's a real pleasure to welcome RNS editor Kevin Ekstrom back to State of Belief. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It happens all the time, and especially in election years, a few stories grab everyone's attention, and in the realm of religion and politics, I guess it's been some of these stories. I'm not a witch, the lost establishment clause, the Park 51 litmus test. My question for you is, do these kinds of stories have a lasting impact, or are they just here as election year hyperboles?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, there are fleeting cases, you know, things like Christine O'Donnell and I'm Not a Witch, and then there are some more important, long-lasting cases like the separation of church and state and whether or not it's actually in the First Amendment, as Christine O'Donnell wondered about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's every campaign, I think, brings out, you know, what you might call the silly season. And we seem to have gotten quite a bit of that this year, I think because we were dealing with a lot of candidates who weren't necessarily the most polished bunch from the Tea Party crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the issues that they raised, however indirectly, I think will be with us for a while.
I think the Park 51 issue is not going away, whether it's related to that particular proposal to build or some other one in the country.
Right, and we're seeing that in Tennessee, in Murfreesboro, just outside of Nashville, where they're having basically a really drawn-out, nasty court case over essentially the question of whether or not Islam is a religion or not, which, you know, in 2010 is kind of remarkable. And it shows a couple of things. One, I guess a lack of basic religious literacy, and you see that all over the place. But if they're not sure about this, that raises some serious questions. But also this year, I think more than any year since 9/11, really saw a resurgence in Islamophobia. And Islamophobia has a negative context, which it should, but just a lot of sort of basic unease over things related to Islam, a lack of knowledge, you know, a distortion of facts. If you're talking about Park 51 in New York, you know, people are saying that it's this mega mosque built overlooking Ground Zero. Well, actually, no, it's not. It's more of a community center two blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
But such distinctions, which are important, tend to get lost in the
sure.
debate.
Kevin, this is a very, very broad question, but are there any patterns that you're seeing that may not be as obvious to someone who is not as deeply involved as you are in covering religion?
Well, I think there is a risk of overinterpreting this election, and specifically the religious message that people were trying to send or not. And at the risk of putting myself out of a job, I don't think that the 2010 elections were a big religious event. We weren't motivated by questions of abortion or same-sex marriage or, you know, the role of religion in the public square. That's not what drove people to the polls. It was the economy, their anxiousness over not having jobs, worries about their mortgage, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a temptation to look at the incoming Congress, which is going to be Republican, at least in the House, and say that values voters or religious conservatives won, you can kind of think of it like the Sunday New York Times. You know, some people buy it for the style section, some people buy it for arts and leisure, some people buy it for politics, and, oh, look, in the middle you get the magazine for free. And that's kind of, I think, what was going on in this election, where people had, they bought the paper for whatever reason, and they're going to get, the religious conservatives are going to get a seat at the table just sort of by, almost by accident.
The truth is, in my opinion as well, that religion probably played a smaller role in this election, at least visibly, than it had in quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, these were not the people who turned out to vote who were so angry and so upset were not upset over the traditional hot-button social issues that tends to motivate religious conservatives. Yeah. It just wasn't on the agenda. And like I said, a lot of the new Republicans, if you want to call them that, sure, they're sympathetic to that agenda, but it's not what they live and breathe off of. Mm-hmm. They've got other issues about the debt and the size of government and things like that. So there are always religious components to elections, and people vote the way they do for lots of reasons, but I don't think Catholics were voting on religious reasons, or mainline Protestants were voting a certain way because they're mainline Protestants. These are people who are worried about the dwindling size of their wallets.
I was going to ask you next about the most significant trend that you saw this year, and not necessarily one that got the most news coverage. I'm wondering, was that it, that religion was not as apparent, or was there another significant trend that you should mention?
What jumped out at me with this election was the lack of basic decency that we saw a lot. And is that a religious issue? Yes and no. Mm-hmm. But sort of our collective inability to talk to each other, that we've lost this sort of sense of who we are kind of as a people that operates kind of by a common moral code, a common vision of what it means to be Americans, and instead of seeing opponents, we saw enemies. And you see that translate into the religious sphere. Elections tend to bring out the worst in people on this issue, where you can't be sympathetic to Muslims' right to build a mosque, for example, because then you're somehow anti-American and pro-jihad. That you can't support a strict separation of church and state in the public square because somehow you must hate Jesus or something like that. And so you know how they say that weddings and funerals tend to bring out the worst in people in a family level. I think elections are sort of the national equivalent of that, where we really are second-guessing the motivations and the convictions and the beliefs of other people, probably for the worst motives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually the thing that I'm most glad about, is that this election is over. And maybe we can start getting back to being who we're supposed to be, and getting we've got some big business to do, and we can't do it if we're constantly shouting at each other.
I'm talking with Kevin Ekstrom of Religion News Service. We've got to take a break. I hate to do that because this is so interesting, but we're going to have more of Kevin's thoughts on religion, politics, and journalism in just a minute. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Kevin Ekstrom, editor of Religion News Service, and we're trying to sort the hyperbole from the truth regarding religion in America and American politics. Kevin, was there one story during the election season that will have an effect on the way people understand and view religious liberty in America in a significant way for a long time?
Not just in the election, but sort of the second half of this year, the whole controversy over Park 51 in New York, and its related ugly stepsisters across the country, over whether or not Muslims are able to operate by the same rules as everybody else, or if they're going to have a different set of circumstances. And I know that I'm supposed to be objective, and I try to be, because that's what they pay me for. But the idea that Muslim Americans aren't fully American, or that they have not as many rights as mm-hmm. anybody else, or that whatever they do is automatically suspect, no matter how many times they try to embrace peace or say that they denounce extremism or whatever. And you saw that mostly in the lead up to the elections, as opposed to the elections themselves. But that is not going to go away easily. It's going to take some time, and it's not just about Muslims. It actually, I think that debate says a lot more about everybody else than it really does about Muslims, and how we resolve that conflict is going to say a lot about who we are as a people.
What does it do to our national dialogue when in media coverage extremists are given equal weight to moderates? And what I mean is when there's a false equivalency created between, for example, someone claiming Islam is not a religion, as you said, and an imam claiming that it is. Isn't the real debate between tolerance and intolerance, regardless of the specifics?
Yeah, and that's where, you know, those of us in the Fourth Estate and the media have a special responsibility. Now, I know you're not Catholic, and I know that this isn't a confessional, but I'll come close here. We actually, at Religion News Service, were the very first news outlet to write about Terry Jones in Florida and his Quran burn back in July
right.
when he announced his plans. We were the first people who wrote about that. And we've gotten a little bit of flack since then. You know, why did you give this guy a platform? I mean, he's obviously a loon. You know, he doesn't deserve to be treated as legitimate, you know, the same way that you would look at Billy Graham or the Pope or whoever else. And I still think we did the right thing there, because obviously the story turned out to be as big of a story as we thought it could. But the media does have a special responsibility, I think, to think critically about, you know, where we devote our time and resources in stories. To if we're going to present somebody, you know, as legitimate, we have to make sure that they actually are. And if they're not, we need to say why they're not. I think there's a special responsibility for cable TV on this one, because it's where so many people get their news, and it, TV is so powerful in capturing people's imaginations and shaping their opinions on things. And the 24/7 shout fest that cable news thrives off of, I think, is actually very harmful to democracy if it's not handled the right way. So, yeah, it's a constant challenge for us in the media, and it's not easy. But if what we try to do is report on these stories well, and to point out who's the, you know, who the legitimate characters are and who isn't, and kind of let people make up their minds. But an uninformed democracy is as bad as one that you know, has no rules.
Kevin, since I have never been in a confessional, I don't know what I'm supposed to say, but I'll just say, bless you, my son.
I think you're supposed to absolve me of my sins and tell me to go sin no more.
Oh, I can tell you to go sin no more, but that's the best I can do. Listen, tell me one other thing before we get together again. What should we keep an eye on? What are you looking for in terms of a major development?
Well, along these lines, and it's a bit predictable because I kind of know the outcome, or I anticipate the outcome, but the Supreme Court case that was heard in October over Fred Phelps, you know, speaking of extremists and his pickets outside of military funerals, I think most people expect the court to reluctantly side with him and his ability and his right to do that. But if they don't, if somehow you know, they come down and say that Fred Phelps is not allowed to do this, that's a pretty major decision. And it would stray from pretty much every Supreme Court precedent on this issue. So I think it's worth watching because it's such an important case, and it does touch on religion and religious views. I'm hoping that I know how this comes out, but I don't have a crystal ball. But that's, I think, something worth watching in the coming months.
Kevin Ekstrom has been with Religion News Service since 2000. He was named editor in 2006 and elected president in 2007. He is now president of the Religion News Writers Association. RNS is a great resource. It's at religionnews.com. If you've never been there, go. Religionnews.com. Kevin, it's always great to have you on State of Belief. This is no exception. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate you having me back.
Still to come on this week's show, what happens when the need for compromise and deeply held ethical convictions collide? We'll explore that question with Dr. Robert Parham of the Baptist Center for Ethics. Stay tuned. This is State of Belief Radio. I'll see you in just a second. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Now let's talk about compromise. I'm curious as to what your first reaction to that word actually was. This past week, USA Today ran a story on Americans' lack of confidence that Washington, meaning the president, members of Congress, can work out a compromise that will prevent major gridlock in our government. Such a view demands cynicism regarding the future because the art of politics and good government demand compromise. Let me tell you a story. Shortly after I graduated from seminary, proud of all of my hammered-out doctrines and carefully honed morals, I heard then-Speaker of the House of Representatives, Jim Wright, a Democrat from Fort Worth, Texas, speak on citizenship. In his remarks, Congressman Wright emphasized the importance of compromise and good government. I found his words abhorrent. And with then-confident self-righteousness, ask how in the world he could be a good Christian and commend compromise. Well, thankfully, the congressman was nicer to me than I deserved, and I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. He took time to explain the difference between political compromise and moral compromise. In recent years, given political rhetoric that sounds more religious than civil, many politicians have decided or at least indicated that political compromise is the same as moral compromise. And that's simply not the case. Moral compromise erodes the foundations of government. Political compromise is the oil that makes the machinery of government run smoothly. My next guest can aid us in this discussion. Dr. Robert Parham is the founding executive director of the Baptist Center for Ethics, and he is joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. Robert, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Welton.
Tell me, how do you speak with people about this thing, this compromise, and how do you distinguish when compromise is appropriate and when it's not?
Well, first, let me say how grateful that I am that you are addressing the issue of compromise. We need to have a lot more discussion in the public square and across the public airwaves about the issue of compromise. When I think about compromise, I immediately think about what Jesus told his followers when he told them to be wise as serpents. He was telling them to practice discernment, to pursue wisdom, to think carefully. He really was telling them to practice serpenthood, if you would. Serpenthood means good judgment, and good judgment helps us know when to compromise and how to compromise. So from my vantage point as a Christian ethicist, I think compromise is rooted in serpenthood, in wisdom, in discernment, in good judgment.
Now that is really interesting. And so those are the values that you would commend to people in developing the discipline of compromise.
I think we have to think much more deeply and carefully about public policy issues and matters of our day. What's happened is that compromise in both the world of faith and the world of politics is too often seen as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, it takes a lot of wisdom to compromise for the common good.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say it takes a lot of courage to compromise.
Yeah.
Compromise may often be a virtue rather than a vice.
Mm-hmm.
Compromise can be seen as a form of self-sacrifice for the common good.
You know, we're not much into sacrifice in government these days. I wonder, when you look at the rigidly entrenched positions of people in different political parties, do you see compromise in our future?
When I watch the deeply entrenched positions in the public square, again, if I may, I think back about a story in the Hebrew Bible when David was preparing for a war against King Saul. And the text tells us that all the tribes came to David's camp. The tribes came with a readiness for battle and reputations for bravery. But one tribe came with neither a reputation for bravery nor a readiness for battle. And that tribe was the tribe of Issachar. And I believe the tribe of Issachar has what every nation needs. The tribe of Issachar came with an understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. And I think one of the reasons we are so entrenched today and inflexible is that we don't have an understanding of our times and we don't know what we ought to do. We retreat to these rigid ideological positions because they're safe havens.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just about know that the discussion on the budget is going to be heated and divisive. And you know, and I know, people that will look at a certain line item in the budget and will say that has to do with a moral issue, and I simply can't compromise on a moral issue. Now, how do you respond to that?
There are certain non-negotiables for people of faith.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, one of the most negotiated away moral imperatives is protecting the poor.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about the budget, I as a Christian begin with an understanding that protecting the poor is a non-negotiable biblical imperative.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there are so many people of faith who represent us in Washington who want to negotiate away protecting the poor in favor of protecting the rich. And so when we talk about taxes, there's all this preferential treatment for those who are the wealthiest among us, and basically they have wandered away from the biblical imperative to protect the poor.
I know that it's far more complicated than this, but one of the things that we hear in those kinds of conversations is the retort, I understand that we should protect the poor, but we also have got to defend the United States, and we've got to have enough money to invest in weaponry, to invest in the Department of Defense. So doesn't it make more sense, the person says, for us to raise the budget of the Department of Defense, even if that takes some money away from poor people, because maybe they can get that money from the church?
Well, first of all, the church is not in a position to serve as the welfare state of the working poor, the low middle class that lack health care insurance. There's just simply no evidence the church can step into that role and adopt poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the fact that that reflects a kind of particular understanding of charity, it ignores the larger biblical call to do social justice.
Mm-hmm.
But to address in particular the issue of military expenditures, David Stockman, I thought, had some very striking statements recently about the fact that this country could no longer be an empire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we need to listen to people like Stockman who are warning us that we cannot afford to be an empire. And we need to listen to the generals and the Pentagon who tell Congress repeatedly that they don't need certain weapon systems, but Congress wants those weapon systems because it serves the self-interest of a corporation in their district or a lobbyist who helps fund their campaign or some other special interest.
Robert, imagine that you're speaking to the initial caucuses of the two major political parties when the new Congress convenes in Washington next January. What would you say to them about how to move through the next 2 years in a way that's beneficial for the nation?
Wouldn't it be wonderful, Welton, if the two major political parties really did invite faith leaders to come spend some serious time with them to talk about how we move forward constructively? Faith leaders that don't have a special interest tied to an ideological position. But to think just quickly about some touchstones mm-hmm. that would need to be offered. I think, number one, practice humility. We need to recognize that we're finite human beings. We are prone to error. We need to be humble about how we advocate our positions and be aware that oftentimes, even for the most righteous motive, we have unintended and very negative consequences.
Mm.
Besides practicing humility, I think we need to learn to speak with civility. Right now, there is so much demonizing of other people.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much indecent speech. I think civility majors on clarity and stays on topic. And we need to avoid a kind of crusading ethic, which says that my cause is so righteous that I can do all kinds of harm to others for the sake of a political victory. That is just ultimately destructive to the nature of our society. A fourth point I would make is that we need to search for truth based upon science and facts, not based upon a literal reading of the Bible or a kind of materialistic ideology. And one other point I would make is that we really do need our leaders to seek the welfare of the culture.
Mm.
And seeking the welfare of the culture means setting aside private gain for the public good.
You know, that's not only a good message for one of the caucus rooms on Capitol Hill. It's a good message for every sector of American life, and I appreciate you elaborating it. We've been talking with Dr. Robert Parham, who is the founding executive director of the Baptist Center for Ethics. Robert, that was good counsel, and thank you for joining us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
My goodness, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of State of Belief Radio. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, listen to show archives, and sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. I hope you'll tell a friend about our show. We'd love to have other listeners joining us. I think if they listen, they'll feel like you do and want to come back. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. There's not been a time in recent history where the cause of religious liberty needed more support. Join us today. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Well, we've got to go, so we'll be back here on State of Belief Radio next week. More stories from the intersection of religion and politics. Probably more surprises. Until then, don't eat too much turkey, and you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.